Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we've got the second half of our end of season awards. He's never done anything. What has he ever done? He got a huge move to a Champions League club now. Like, yeah. He's done absolutely nothing to merit it. And he's a dickhead. We bring you the Burn Book, as usual.
This sacred event is one of the very, very few British traditions that I would like to attach myself to. Because it's just different.
While over on the paid side, we take your questions on which team could break into the Premier League elite. They are deservedly third, but being the third best team in the Premier League is a lot like being kind of, you know, the sixth, seventh best team in Europe. And I think that is kind of where they are right now. And we ask, who is the arsehole? That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we are back after a lengthy hiatus. Pete Dorman, you're back again. How are you doing?
I'm back. I'm pretty well. I'm quite tired. Been quite busy for the last few weeks, here, there and everywhere. But we are here. I am here in South London. You are technically South London?
Southwest.
On a lovely balmy Tuesday evening. We've never done one of these on a Tuesday before. Very early in the week.
That's true. But you couldn't tell that it's balmy because you're wearing a hoodie.
Well, yeah, I mean, aesthetic over comfort always.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Beauty is pain or whatever it is. Yeah. Suffering, I don't know. I've never needed to think about it, Pete. But yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. Like, I'm worried that I'm approaching Leonardo DiCaprio season when things get over 25 and I get uncomfortable. So I'm not looking forward, actually, to the temperature ticking up, to be honest. 17 is like the upper bound for me.
Has Leonardo DiCaprio season not been recently heightened to like a 28, or are those just unsubstantiated rumors?
I think
his recent or current paramour is alarmingly over 25.
I thought this was because he was spotted like hanging out with like Timothée Chalamet and everyone was like Leo, he's 26. What are you doing, man? I did not know that. I presume that it's a clerical error and probably his personal assistant's gonna get fired over it. But either way, look, I don't really want to talk to anyone under 25 except for my daughter. I certainly don't want to experience a temperature over 25. Neither one is good for me. I just need to operate in the middle.
What, as in like a nice, what's your optimal temperature? If you could choose a temperature, it would always be, what would that be?
No, I don't know, like, I would say, honestly, probably like 15.
Like, beige.
Yeah, I know. I do enjoy it a bit warmer than that, but I'm thinking about the fact that I vastly prefer my autumn-winter wardrobe to summer wardrobe. So that's a factor.
Yeah, that is a good point that I had not considered. I prefer to layer than
Clearly.
Constrained to like shorts and a t-shirt. But if I had to choose, I would definitely choose like a 20, 21.
That's quite reasonable though, you know. Yeah. That's not crazy.
It's workable. It's you don't need a jacket. You don't even need to concern yourself with a jacket. You can dine outside, drinks outside, everything can be done outside until about 10 PM every evening. And yeah, it's a manageable temperature where you can still operate at a normal level without feeling like gross.
Yeah.
Just like really sweaty. Or if you walk 400 meters to somewhere else, you're like covered in sweat.
Yes.
When it gets problematic.
If I could guarantee a breeze, I can tolerate a higher temperature. I think there is no pleasure like, you know, being in the med, like having supper out al fresco, or even just having a drink outside in the summer, like in the city, if there is a breeze. But when there isn't, I'm just like, I'm sweating, I'm hot, I'm miserable, I don't like what I'm wearing, I'm like, everything about this absolutely sucks.
We were in Seville last year and got caught, which is naturally a hot place generally. I think it's called the frying pan of Spain. But we just happened to be there in a really big heat snap. And most days around 1 PM, it was like 41.
Fuck.
which was, I'd never experienced something like that before. And
Australian levels.
When, luckily we booked a place which had a pool, like a communal pool on the roof.
Yeah.
So pretty much between like 1 and 3, you just kind of stayed in the pool. You didn't really do anything else. But when you left the house, you just got hit by this like unbelievable wall of heat, because the house was obviously air conditioned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you got lulled into a false sense of security. And then as soon as you opened the door, it was just this wave of heat, like really dry heat that hit you. And the last day before we left, it dropped to 29. And I swear, it felt like 2 degrees to me. It was like, the air felt so like clean and almost like wet. And I was like, oh my God, this is delightful.
What, the refreshing slap of 29 degree weather.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's under 30.
Oh, God.
But would definitely recommend Seville. Would probably recommend trying to avoid temperatures north of 35.
Well, I am actually going to Seville with the family in September. There you go.
What temperature will it be?
Supposedly considerably less than that. Supposedly cool. It's meant to be, I think like sort of upper 20s, low 30s. Mm. But I mean, when we went to Florence with the baby, it was like 36, 37. And at the time I was like, Jesus, this is going to be awful. But actually it was fine. And then when we came home, it was like 40 degrees. So like, it is what it is. Like, there's no way to avoid it. I don't know. And also when you have the baby, you're like, she is asleep in the middle of the day. So we'll just like siesta in aircon, head out a bit later. It's kind of nice. And plus, when we go continental, we keep the baby on UK time. We try and keep her on UK time. So she's getting up at 8 in the morning rather than 7. And she's going down at 8 in the evening. So she gets a little bit more time out of the heat, I would say.
Yeah. And you're also cheating an extra hour in bed.
Yeah, but you're losing an hour in the evening.
Yeah, but you would be up anyway.
True. It's just, you know, you what do you want? The extra hour in bed or cocktail
extra hour? In bed,
it's a difficult question.
You can have both, Patrick. You're on holiday.
No, you get neither. Absolutely get neither. Okay, right. Yes. Yeah. So a few weeks ago, we obviously did the first round of our team of the not team of the season stuff, but kind of end of season awards, like disappointment, overrated, underrated, blah, blah, blah. We thought we'd bring you a few more of those because also, let's be honest, it's been a bit thin on the ground. You know, like Champions League's been and gone. Even if we'd done the podcast last week, man, the Champions League was pretty unexciting. So we're going to do a few awards today because I think that there is some stuff to talk about. So we were going to start off with our player of the year, our non-Erling Haaland player of the year. Do you want to start or shall I?
I can start.
Cool, go ahead.
So there are obvious shouts for Harry Kane and Kevin De Bruyne, but personally, fuck both of them. Don't really care about them.
Agree. Both boring.
One because of a personal agenda against City, and one because I've never been overly interested in anything that Harry Kane does.
No, I can't stand the man.
He's just super vanilla in every sense of the word. Then on top of that, there is also somebody who's clear, but I feel that you will probably touch on them. So
you're probably right.
I will avoid them, at least for now. But
I'm going to try and provide a new angle on the very obvious thing that I'm going to say.
But the one I'm going to go for is a totally unbiased Casemiro for Player of the Year.
Player of the Year?
Right, okay, so here we are.
Hasn't he played like 22 games or something? That's crazy.
No. Here, right. Okay, so this might be better suited to a signing of the season category, but I'm pushing him in here because I do feel that it is important to recognize the impact he's had since he's arrived and how he has arguably been United's best or most important player this season.
Okay.
Obviously, Rashford has scored a ton of goals and everybody was saying, oh, he's world-class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Rashford was much more hot and cold than Casemiro, in my opinion, this season.
I think that's fair.
So I feel that across the whole season, Casemiro has been more influential. Now, obviously, Varane, Martinez, Bruno Fernandes, they have all been big players, but when they've kind of been substituted in with their kind of lesser understudies, like a Luke Shaw at centre-back, United have looked worse, but they've not looked absolutely abysmal. It's been fine, manageable.
Yeah.
But a United with a midfield with a Casemiro has looked notably problematic at times. Seriously problematic. And Casemiro's come in and kind of done exactly what you would expect Casemiro to do. He is just an elite level defensive midfielder. Provide top tier stability to a pretty weak, probably the weakest part of United's squad over the past few years, that defensive midfield role. And also provide more cover to, again, a historically kind of shaky defence. At least pre-Martinez, shaky centre-back pairings. And Casemiro's come in and done that kind of just perfectly, as you would expect somebody of his quality to do. You know, he's in the top 2% of Premier League midfielders for tackles per 90, tackles in the defensive third, dribblers tackled, tackles and interceptions, clearances, aerial duels, touches in the defensive third. All top 2% for midfielders in that category. Like, the guy is, he's just a behemoth when it comes to defensive output and shielding United's kind of back four and just kind of protecting that kind of middle of the park, getting involved, slowing down or stopping attacks before they become really problematic, which historically over the past four, five, six seasons, United have had a real problem with that. They have given up big chances when they've not necessarily... A smarter, more intelligent player in that position could have mitigated a lot of that threat earlier had they been smarter, had they engaged earlier up the pitch, had they done whatever. So he's done exactly what we thought he would do. But the impact that's had on our defence and our defensive output has been staggering. Since he arrived in the end of August. So since his first game, I think, was Southampton, match week 4. United have conceded 34 goals in 33 games, which is the third best defensive record in the league behind Newcastle and City. And the same is for their expected goals against, third behind Newcastle and City. So for a guy who's putting out these numbers, top 2% in all of those categories I just said, to have a defence that is that solid, at least in terms of not conceding and not, you know, they're not massively overperforming their expected goals against. They are slightly, but they're still third in that table. Yes. So it's not like it's a massive just run of luck or anything like that. But for him to have that input on those personal numbers and then subsequently to have that team performance, you have to put, obviously other factors like other players are involved, but you have to put a lot of the weight onto his performances. And compare that to the fact that United's defence last year was 13th across the season in terms of goals conceded. So that is an absolutely stark uptick in one season. Less than a season, but sure, we can count this as an entire season. But I think the most impressive thing about this, however, isn't that. Because that's exactly what you expect a Casemiro to do in this United squad. That's what United have been crying out for, an absolute elite-level defensive midfielder. What I think is more impressive, though, is how important he has been in our attacking play. Because his 12-goal involvement, across all competitions are only beaten by Bruno and Rashford.
It's a part of his game that like we just haven't really seen. I mean, I know he's like scored in the Champions League final with a massive deflection and stuff, but like I've been surprised how often his name has popped up in the goal and assist charts.
When you think of Casemiro, you do not think of a top level attacking output, or at least a consistent level of attacking output.
Sure.
And yet he's sitting third in United's goal involvements in all competitions this season. And, you know, his underlying numbers are really good as well. You know, he's a top third for non-penalty goals, assists, goal involvement, expected goals, shots on target, progressive passes, goal-creating actions from open play. Like, he is in the top third of all of those numbers for midfielders in the Premier League this season, which is really impressive considering a lot of people would only really consider Casemiro to be a defensive midfielder brought in to break down play and win possession back. So to be contributing those numbers at that level across this season, across the entire season, is really, really impressive. And it's been really important. He scored some really important goals for United as well. You know, he scored in the Carabao Cup final. He scored against Brentford the other day, that overhead. He scored big goals and big moments. And it's very easy to overlook his input going forward because of how good he is defensively. Like, his attacking attributes are not as good as his defensive attributes. But that does not mean his attacking attributes are not very good.
Mm.
And then if you look at how he's been essentially an absolutely almost ever-present fixture in the side, it shows just how important he's been, because he's made 48 appearances this season across all competitions. Only Bruno, Rashford and De Gea have made more. Now, take into account, Casemiro missed the first three games because he wasn't a United player. Well, he wasn't a United player for the first two games, and then he arrived in Manchester on the day of the third game against Liverpool. And he's been suspended for 8 of those games.
Yeah,
which is a problem in itself.
Is the thing, like, if you guys had missed out on the Champions League, you would look at those suspensions and you'd say,
I mean, you could argue that the throat grab one was slightly unlucky given the intent of it wasn't seemingly there. It was seemingly a mistake, however, whatever. We don't necessarily need to get into that. But he's missed 11 games through either not being a United player or being suspended. So that means, had he been available for all of those, he would be on 59 appearances this season. 3 more than Bruno's, 56. So that just shows how reliant Erik ten Hag is on him, how important Casemiro is to this system and to how this system is performing well. Yeah. United went from being a bit of a nothing team last year. Like I said, 13th best defensive record in the league, to now being in two domestic finals, having won one of them already, and pretty much to have secured Champions League. You know, obviously, technically, mathematically, Liverpool can still leapfrog us on goal difference. But United need 1 point across their last two games to secure a top four position.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
And I'm not saying that this is solely down to Casemiro. I'm just saying that he has been a huge, huge part of it at both ends of the pitch. And also just in terms of his mentality, his leadership, everything about him. I think he has been a real underrated performer this season. I think he's been phenomenal.
I don't know if he's been underrated. I do think people think he's been good.
Yeah, but I think he's been really good.
Okay, well, here's the thing, though. I think I've actually been a bit too generous to Man United this season. In that, my general angle has been first year of a rebuild, getting top four, pretty amazing. And yes, I would argue it's more down to the teams around them being crap than United being particularly good. But United certainly look better. They're taking steps in the right direction, blah, blah, blah. Now, when I think about it, I'm like, there hasn't been a rebuild. You know, this is not the first year of a rebuild. Okay, you got in Antony and Lisandro, who's relatively young. But actually, the work done to the squad has not really made it significantly younger. Like, Malacia is not going to be a regular.
No.
You're still reliant on guys, mostly, who've been there for quite a long time, or guys who are older, like Eriksen, like Casemiro. So from that, and also it's not even really like the style has started to come in. I've got to say, like, this is not to say Ten Hag hasn't done interesting tactical stuff, but I don't think that he's currently, it doesn't even feel like he's building towards his normal style. I think for the moment he's doing what he can to make things work. And it is working. Like, it is working. He deserves credit for that. But from that point of view, I think, is a rebuild actually happening? And so when you have that in mind, then I think, well, actually, if a team signs Casemiro and they sign Eriksen and even Lisandro, you know, my argument would be you're signing those to do something now. And so from that point of view, I think you kind of had to get in the Champions League to make the Casemiro signing worthwhile. Like, if you hadn't got in the Champions League, what would have been the point of the Casemiro signing? So from that point of view, he's fulfilled the reason you got him. I think that is good. That is good. Narrowly, I think if the season went 3 weeks longer, it might be a bit scary with Liverpool coming up like a steam train. But yeah, I think he individually has been sensational. I do think the bans are a bit of a knock on him, so I wouldn't like put him in like the team of the season. But I think you're right in that United are going to finish in the top four. Who is the person who makes United good? It is Casemiro, basically. It's Casemiro, Lisandro Martinez, and I would argue, you know, Bruno. And I actually think Rashford's part has been massively overstated. I think Rashford's had a weird... people get fixated on goal numbers, and his goal numbers are good, but they're not like mind-blowing, and he doesn't really do anything else. I think Bruno has had like an underrated season. Casemiro and Lisandro Martinez, I think people know that they've been good, but I'll be honest, if I see either of them in the team of the season, I'm gonna be putting nails in baseball bats and stuff. I'm gonna be furious.
I could see Casemiro getting in there, or maybe he would have if he hadn't missed fucking so many games.
Yeah, I guess central midfield is a little bit thin, but still, okay. I think Casemiro, good enough. Hugely biased shout, but I'm fine with that.
I mean, I did say it would be better fitted as a signing of the season, but I just
good caveat.
I did just want to shout out Casemiro because he's fucking sick.
All right, man, whatever. All right, my player of the year, I'm going to say Odegaard, and I know I spoke about him before. And Kane probably does deserve a shout, but like you say, very boring, man. Spurs have been appalling. They bottled the Europa League. Like, genuinely, Spurs are going to, like, finish eighth.
Yeah. I mean, they could finish Europa Conference League.
Woof. What a season. This is when people are like, this year, they're going to be closer to Liverpool and City. And now we're, like, Conference League. That is bananas. And, like, it's so weird to me how everyone's like, Spurs are weak, Spurs are bottlers. But no one says that about Harry Kane when he is the captain of the bottlers. But, okay. All right. So with Odegaard, because I've talked a bit about him before, I do think it's worth maybe talking about what's different about him this season. Like, what's actually changed in his game? Because it has been pretty remarkable. I mean, obviously the goal and assist numbers, 15 goals, 7 assists in the league alone is crazy. But when you look at his numbers, there's been a really remarkable shift in one area. So top 2% for shot creating actions, for expected assists, for touches in the box. This is all great stuff. Top 1% for expected goals for people in his position. Top 1% for shots. That is interesting. Because I expect him to be among the best players for playing progressive passes, for passing into the penalty area. I think he's third for passes into the penalty area this season. But I think to be a truly elite attacking midfielder, you do have to have a goal threat of your own. And he's pretty much added it in the course of one season. So last year, his expected goals and assists per game were at 0.36. This year, it's jumped to 0.52. And that's almost entirely down to his own XG. So he's gone from taking 1.7 shots a game, which is like fine. It's not particularly good. It's respectable. To 2.7 this year. And now he's in the top 1% of all midfielders for shots taken. That is pretty staggering that he's done that in one season. He's really become like a super goal threat himself. And what's interesting is whenever you see Odegaard get a shot in the box, it always feels like it's slightly more open than you would think. Like, you see him so often getting a shot completely unmarked in the box. He's really good at that. And that's partially about how many players Arsenal get in the box. I think they're, along with Bayern, maybe get the most players in the box among all European sides. But Odegaard is such a clean ball striker as well that he has managed to overconvert. Now, I think he's, you know, he is really like juicing his expected goals, but he clearly has shown that he is going to be a quality goal contributor. So I think that's a really interesting change in his game, because when Odegaard came into Arsenal, he was like the definition of neat and tidy. Like, he had some expected assists, but not crazy. He was creating chances, but not crazy. He was doing like solid passing work in midfield, but not crazy. But this season, huge progressive pass numbers, huge passes into the final third, huge progressive passes received, like big outlet passer, receiver between the lines, amazing goal threat. Like, all of this stuff has happened almost overnight. I've said before that I think WHO scores ratings are bullshit, but He leads Arsenal for Man of the Match awards in Who Scored's ratings this season. They've given him Man of the Match 7 times this year. Saka and Martinelli, they've given it 8 times between them. That's how often he's been their Man of the Match. And I will say that there have been more games this season where I thought Arsenal haven't played well than there have been games where I thought Odegaard didn't play well. And I can't think of a game where Arsenal did play well, but he didn't. If he plays well, the team is better. He is never a passenger. Whereas I can think of games where Martinelli wasn't at it, or Saka wasn't at it, or even Gabriel Jesus wasn't at it, and certainly the midfielders and the defenders. I can think of games where basically everybody let the side down. But I really, really, really struggle to think of games where he did. His consistency this season has been pretty staggering. And to have him and Saka and Martinelli and Jesus in the front line with the prospect maybe of somebody being added this summer is pretty amazing. So I really think that it's not just that he's been playing in a better side, it's that he is one of the reasons Arsenal are a better side. Whereas I think Saka's actually been... Saka's goals and assist numbers, he's out over his skis more than Odegaard is. Like, I mean, like, he's a little bit lucky to have 24 goal involvements in the league. But I really think that it kind of conceals that the true star of this side right now is the captain. So yeah, I don't know. I think he deserves a lot of credit. I think that truly this is not even a Homer shout. I don't think, like, I think he has been the second best player in the league this season to Haaland. Yeah. I find it really hard to, I mean, I guess you could make a case for somebody like Rodri. You can maybe make a case for a couple of goalkeepers, but like I think it goes Haaland, Odegaard. That it's as simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we didn't have Haaland, the player of the season would probably still go to Harry Kane because how the league prioritizes goals, essentially. But realistically speaking, Martin Odegaard, yeah, I would agree that he has been the second best player in the league, including Haaland.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
And I don't even think it's that close either. I don't actually think it's that close between those two, those two and the rest.
I don't think it's that close either. Like... If you take out Kane's penalties this season...
He's got like 23 goals.
Then he'll be on like 26 goal involvements altogether. Yeah. So he'll be marginally ahead of Odegaard. He's played about 300 more minutes.
And also that's all Harry Kane brings though, really. Like, oh, that is his meat and veg.
Yeah.
He scores goals and assists. Whereas you just mentioned all of the extra stuff that Odegaard does.
He leads the press as well, man. Like, I mean, honestly, he is the guy, like, whenever the chips are down, actually, the instinct is to think maybe Saka will do something. But actually, when the chips are down, it is almost always Odegaard. To some extent, Zinchenko as well. Mm-hmm. But it's almost always Odegaard who's like, this is the guy. This is the guy who's going to do it. And he will start picking up the ball deeper and he'll start driving on more. But he doesn't lose his cool. And it's...
How much is that to do with the fact that you just don't have that many players who are comfortable in that role?
What do you mean? Like, which
role? In terms of when the chips are down, being like, I'm going to be the game changer here. Like, taking onus of a game and ownership of a scenario. I kind of feel like Zinchenko and Odegaard are your kind of two guys. Xhaka as well.
Jesus does it too. Like, Jesus, you often see, starts to drop deeper and starts to really... like get involved in build up. Like, I think in the Chelsea game, was it the Chelsea game that I'm thinking of, where he was just like, okay, and started dropping into midfield and was a huge reason that it was easy to kind of build. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Like, I think there are leaders in the Arsenal team, but I think that the general leadership level is relatively low. But it's also just the coolness that he and Zinchenko have, right? Mm. Like, there are guys who will try and do it, like Xhaka, and I think sometimes Saka and Martinelli, but they don't have the composure. Whereas Odegaard, when he's trying to force the game, he doesn't just start giving it away. He doesn't start doing stupid shit or taking shots from range like our midfielders do. He still understands that we need to play a certain way. He still understands that the best way to maximize our odds of getting something are to continue to play the way we do. So it's that kind of match intelligence. And really, he is. It's kind of funny that, like, he's very Mesut Özil-y, really, yeah. But with a much, much more aggressive presence, much more consistency, and real leadership quality. So I think he's just had a phenomenal season. And to get 22 goals and assists from a kind of hybrid 8-10 role is pretty remarkable. So he makes me pretty optimistic for the future of Arsenal. Should we move on?
Yeah.
All right, so next up, we've got biggest prick of the season. Biggest prick of the season. My one's really quick. I just wanted to talk about Javier Tebas, who is the president of La Liga. Obviously, recently, we've been seeing, once again, all the racial abuse directed at Vinicius Jr. And the fact that there's this narrative in Spain, which is just kind of like normalized, which is, oh, well, Vinicius provokes his opponents and he says shit to his opponents, and like that's why everyone hates him. And the fact that this has been linked with the conversation about racism is absolutely beyond me, as if like you can be such a prick during a game that somebody is allowed to be racist to you. You know, even today, I think there was a Valencian paper that was like publishing it had a front page with a hand up that said enough now. And it wasn't referring to the racism aimed at Vinicius. It was referring to the fact that Real Madrid are going on an offensive against Valencia and saying that the Mestalla is a racist stadium. It's absolutely insane. And among all this, the president of La Liga, you would really want to take control of this situation and say, look, if people have issues with the way Vinicius behaves on the pitch, that's one thing. But that's absolutely nothing to do with racism aimed at him, which is always unacceptable under all circumstances. He hasn't done that. Every time Vinicius says, please protect me, this is ridiculous, I'm racially abused every week, they literally put an effigy of me. Like they hung it from like a bridge. Like this is beyond what you'd expect from even racist football fans. Javier Tebas every time is so angry, and he says, actually, we've done more than anyone has ever done before to try and stop racism in the league. Like, this league isn't racist. And truly, it's almost like they think it's worse to be called racist than to be complicit in allowing racism to continue in the league. They're like, they know it's not good to be called racist, but they don't seem to actually really think seriously about whether their actions protect racists. So La Liga doesn't do enough about racism. To be honest, when they get the courts involved, the courts don't do enough about racism either. And the fact that he thinks every time Vinicius complains about this, that this is his cue to go and defend his conduct as president of La Liga is insane to me, when instead he should think, yeah, this is like a really young man who is suffering racist abuse like every week. Like maybe that's my fucking job to deal with that. So anyway, I think he's quite clearly the biggest prick of the year. There are a lot of biggest pricks this year. I think your one's going to be a little bit more fun.
I've gone down a slightly different route to you. Okay. I did actually see that name on the sheet before, and I did wonder who it was. Didn't Google it though, because I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah, but, fair enough.
Fully agree with everything that's just been said. But my biggest prick of the year is Anthony Gordon.
Oh my God. I love this guy, man. He's my favorite player.
It's amazing the mentality he has. Yeah.
He got a huge move to a Champions League club now. Like, he's done absolutely nothing to merit it. And he's a dickhead. Like, he can never go back to Liverpool.
He is such a petulant little twat. Honestly, there's not many footballers who rub me up the wrong way as much as he does, and I don't know why it is. Like even just looking at him kind of irritates me a bit. But yeah. I think part of it's because he's got such a big, or apparently he seemingly has such a big ego for being such an average player.
Yeah,
like he is absolutely bang average. I have no idea why Newcastle paid 45 mil for him, but sure. Whatever, you know, they're the richest club in the Premier League now, so perhaps they don't care. But that has done nothing more but just to inflate his ego further. And in doing that move, he's burned pretty much every bridge that has ever existed between Newcastle and Liverpool. absolutely destroyed his relationship with his boyhood club. Even was seen fist pumping after Newcastle beat Everton 4-1 last month. He played 4 minutes and had 7 touches in that game. So I don't really understand why you would even do that. So that result left Everton, his boyhood club, in 19th. He played 4 minutes and touched the ball 7 times. Okay, sure. If you scored a last-minute winner for your new team, I can understand you being kind of a bit pumped up. You played 4 minutes, touched the ball 7 times, and you come off the pitch fist-pumping that you've just like dumped your... At that stage, it looked like dumped Everton out of the Premier League.
Jesus.
And I understand that people get pumped and are competitive and that, but it's not that difficult to just not be a prick in that situation. Just read the room a bit. Like, read the room. Understand that you haven't really done much at Newcastle yet, nor did you do much or anything in that match.
He's never done anything. What has he ever done? Like, the only thing that makes me sad about Anthony Gordon is that Chelsea did not get to pay, like, a prince's ransom for him, which would have been incredible.
I mean, they paid enough for Joao Felix's loan fee, so, you know. Fine.
Oh, God, yeah.
But, yeah, he's legitimately made no impact at Newcastle. And yet, he also seems to always, like, throw the toys out of the pram when he gets substituted. He got substituted on against Brentford at half time, and then substituted off again, like, in injury time. Obviously a time-wasting tactical thing. And he started throwing the toys out of the pram. It's like, you've moved from Everton to Newcastle, who are now a legitimately good club and are only probably going to get better. You are average at best. Stay in your lane.
At best.
Stay in your lane. Be happy to be there. Honestly, be happy to be there. Be happy the fact you got on the pitch at all. And he starts throwing the toys out of the pram. Since he arrived in Newcastle, he's made 3 starts since February.
Jesus, really?
He's lasted 61, 55 and 45 minutes respectively. His other 12 appearances are all from the bench, and he's got a little over 400 minutes on the pitch. So he's averaging less than 28 minutes per appearance. Add to that the fact he's got 0 goal involvements and 1 shot on target. This guy is just the definition of butters.
And this is a team that, like, got a healthy goal involvement kind of tally out of Miguel Almirón. It's not like, well, look, you know, we just play a highly specialised system and you can't, you know, we're like Pep Guardiola. Like, if you can't do juego de posición, then you're never going to play here. It's like Longstaff has played well for Newcastle this season. Yeah. Like, How are you not shining in this, like, hard-working, like, hard-running, like, I don't know, they're like a pretty like, blue-collar side, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I just don't understand it. Like, what is his fucking problem?
He's, 0 goal involvement, 1 shot on target in 15 appearances. And yet he just comes with this immense ego that he just thinks he's way better than he is, when he's not. Just get in the bin. He's just, please just disappear in the obscurity and just be, a sad little footnote on Newcastle's rise to the Champions League. He also celebrated the champ. I think I saw an article today. He was, he tweeted or put on Instagram last night or a couple of nights ago when Newcastle qualified for the Champions League, being like, really happy to be here. Can't wait for
to come.
It's
bro,
like, mate, you're going to be playing with the reserve next season, so it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just like somebody telling you, like, how much they're over their ex all the time. You're like, but you're not. Like,
follow on 3 different burner accounts.
And also, you're like, Anthony Gordon presumably knows some of the people at Everton who are not earning 100k a week, but might actually, like, lose their jobs if Everton get relegated and subsequently, like, turn into, I don't know, like a black hole of debt. Like, I just don't understand this attitude. Like, the fact that he thinks that the whole season is about him and that Everton fans are thinking about him all the time when their club could get relegated. He's just a fucking bell end. Like, it would be he could have actually rebuilt these bridges as well by being like, you know, I love the club, don't want to see him get relegated, blah, blah, blah. Like, I did feel like it was my time to leave, you know, all that. And I also felt like the club could benefit from bringing in that fee. But instead, he's just like, no, fuck them. How dare they?
Grealish from Villa to City. Nobody really held that against him that much.
No, it's, well, I mean, not anyone sensible.
Because he did it in a more palatable way. It was like, I'm not, like, I love Villa, but I'm not going to turn down City.
And they got a prince's ransom for him.
Yeah. If Anthony Gordon was in any way more intelligent than he perhaps is, this could have been navigated far more amicably. However, it's not, because he's a little prick.
£45 million, man. Fucking hell. Like, what is the point? Yeah, it's kind of funny that that Newcastle made a £45 million signing in January and he's just like not been a factor at all. And the fact that he's been crap hasn't even affected their Champions League run.
Yeah,
all right, fuck him. I really hope that he plays more next season but is crap. moving on to funniest moment, because to be honest, Anthony Gordon could have been in that as well. I wrote down some possibilities here.
I have loads.
Tuchel Conte, handshake this season. Yeah. Amazing stuff. Klopp celebrating, pulling his hamstring. Yeah. Very funny. I also think when he didn't watch Mo Salah's penalty against Arsenal, did a little fist pump, turned around and realised Salah had missed. Incredible. Anthony had that message on his undershirt that he showed during the lineup before the game, and somebody said, yeah, he knew he wasn't going to score.
We're playing Wolves.
Richarlison, obviously we've spoken about before, Richarlison getting booked for goals that ultimately didn't stand, I think is incredible. But I've got to say, I do think the 7-0 at Anfield is probably the funniest, because it was right in the middle of one of Man United's many title charges this season. And I love how United fans ultimately change their mind to be like, see, how dare Arsenal fans get annoyed with Gary Neville for saying that Arsenal would not win the league, as opposed to what they were saying before, which is, oh, we're only like a couple of wins away from Arsenal. Like, I think we'll beat them. And how many United fans said to me, well, we're clearly one of the two best sides in the league, meaning them and Arsenal at that stage, not even City. So I thought the 7-0 at Anfield, especially because it was like, there was something before it, wasn't there, where they were like, you know that when Lisandro starts, like, United have the best defence in the league, and they've never lost a game or whatever the fuck. They've never conceded more than one goal
more than
in a game.
One goal, yeah.
And then they subsequently lost 7-0 at Anfield. Very funny. Even though I felt the result was quite harsh, I felt that it was also merited on a sort of spiritual level. So, yeah, that was one of my highlights of the season. I got
like for previous sins, it was
yeah,
karma.
Exactly.
It was karmic 7-0.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, for me, that wasn't an overly funny moment. Actually, at points it was a bit funny because it was like that second half, that first 10 minutes of that second half was just ridiculous. But other ones of mine include everything about Spurs' managerial approaches this season. From getting like absolutely mugged off by Conte, who was just digging out the entire club, the entire squad, the entire institution publicly in press conferences before just leaving.
Just hates Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah.
Just absolutely hates them. I really rate that about Conte.
For them to then go and try and get Pochettino mugged off, to get Nagelsmann, who then comes out and says, no, don't want to go to this club because of how... I think he said it's a club in turmoil. Or a club that's just not in a place that he wants to be in. Getting mugged off by all of them. Pathetic little club. Hilarious. Also loved Jack Grealish's interview where he said that whatever it was the best thing since sliced veg.
That is pretty great. I mean, that's a real, like, that's a real Zachism. That's like a Zach Jellobism.
Oh, for sure. But, oh, unbelievable. And he then actually came out after it went viral, said that he did say bread, but if you listen to it, he 100% said veg.
He 100% said veg, and everyone knows it.
I also loved the Gary Lineker prank on the BBC's coverage of the FA Cup.
Sure.
When somebody taped a phone behind his chair and played pornographic noises through it, live on air.
When you Hilarious. Say somebody, was that not you?
It was absolutely... Well, yeah, me and my long-standing affiliation with BBC... and their productions. But the one I want to put in is from a notably unfunny and rather terrible man, definitely terrible man, but this little part of it is really funny, was the publishing of Ryan Giggs's erotic poetry.
Oh, fuck, was that this season?
That was a very start. I think it was summer. I think we might be scraping through in a technicality.
I'll allow it. Preseason counts.
But I'll just give you my two favorite highlights of this amazing.
Oh my god! Are you actually going to read this out?
I'm going to read two little snippets from it. So the end of one of the poems that he sent to this woman reads, "I'm going to end by saying you're my love, my friend, my soul, and most of all, you believe in me, which makes me feel hard like a totem pole."
It makes me feel hard.
Yeah. Makes me feel as hard as a totem pole.
Okay, but it doesn't make him hard. It makes him feel
as hard.
As a totem pole?
Yeah, because what else would rhyme with soul? Of course, he's going A, A, B, B, C, C in terms of his rhyme scheme.
Okay, right, that's his rhyme scheme. Okay, right. Well, but I suppose there are other kinds of pole, but totem pole, I feel like, has some
odd
interesting
connotations.
Pretty sure, like, aren't totem poles, like, quite important, like, spiritual objects to indigenous people?
Yeah.
Mm, interesting.
Again, you're asking a lot of the history and geopolitical knowledge of Frank Giggs here.
Sure, but he's got the internet.
I mean,
you know what?
When you hear the next one, you'll really understand.
My love, my friend, my soul is actually like weirdly. I'd say it's a really screeching gear change to be like, you're my love, my friend, my soul.
Nice. And you also give me a massive erection.
Yeah, and then it's just like, you give me a massive erection, like. That reminds me of, like, you know, the Native American, like, populations of North America.
It's just a flow, how that flows from one, because that's obviously a rhyming couplet. So the fact that those are together, they're paired.
I think it's strong just, to call this a couplet. Like,
it's just baffling.
Let's look at the scansion, though. Like, I'm going to end by saying, like, don't need to say that. I'm going to end by saying, you are my love, my friend, my soul. And most of all, you believe in me. Full stop. Which makes me feel as hard as a totem pole. Like, it's just like, when you say it's got this rhyme structure, like, all we're going on there is like the line breaks as opposed to the actual scansion of the poem.
Yeah, no, it's literally just the last word will rhyme with another word that is coming up.
Sorry, I've just seen the acrostic thing. Can we please move on to that immediately?
So there's... There was also an acrostic version, and the woman in question, her surname was Greville.
Great. Well, great for her that everyone knows that. Fuck.
Well, I mean, this is widely published as well.
Oh, God.
But old Ryan sent her an acrostic poem spelling out her name, and it read as such. G is for gorgeous. R is for radiant. Oh. E is for extraordinary. V is for vivacious. Nice. I is for idolized by me.
Sorry, that's parenthetical. Like, in brackets, it says idolized by me.
Brackets,
just so that we know, like, what... Yeah, okay,
yeah,
got you.
Sure. L is for legs. L is for legs. And E is for everything I have wanted. There's two L's in it, and he just goes, L is for legs.
Okay.
L is also still for legs.
Okay, but if he said the L's are for legs, you know, like if he'd done something to signify,
that's actually
like,
quite smart.
Yeah, if he'd done something like that and he was like, look, you've got two legs. I like
there's
legs. They come in pairs. There are two L's. They've also come in a pair. Like then you'd say, oh, there's some like sort of he's self-conscious. He's being silly on purpose as opposed to L is for legs. L is for legs. Like E is for eggs. Like
honestly, fucking like... The repetition of L is for legs with the full sincerity that it was meant with is honestly better than like 90% of any comedy writing I've ever seen.
Oh my God, that's so good.
If somebody wrote that intentionally funny, that is unbelievably right. Unbelievably
it's extremely
written.
Partridge-y. Like,
it's
I've got
so
to say, like,
it's very Brent-y. Yeah.
Yeah, it is very Brent-y, but like, actually no, because like when David Brent like sings a song in The Office, it's better than this, like as poetry. I don't know, man, like... This is how I feel when people are like, The Lord of the Rings is my favourite book. And I'm like, you do realise on every page there's a song and they all suck. Like, this is how I feel about them. But
they are still significantly better than L is for legs, L is for leg.
You know what's weirder about this is that, like, Ryan Giggs, I'm sure, is the kind of guy who thinks that, like, poetry generally is for, like wet bitches, like, not for, like, real men like him. But when he writes romantic poetry, it is actually, like, the wettest, it's like the poetry that, like, a unicorn would write, like, on a children's TV show. You can send someone a sext that is not, like, this flowery. You can write someone a poem that isn't just like, I like it when you smile and I like it when you laugh. I like to see your leg and your other leg in the bath. Like, it's just fucking stupid.
What I really enjoy about his poetry is that he marries these really soppy sentiments with just like, oh, and also I'm erect. And, you
and also, I want to smash a door in.
He starts a sentence or with like the soppy stuff, and then he's like, "Oh, by the way, though, I'm still like a bloke. I'm gonna smash you. You're fit. Like L is for legs. You make me hard as a totem pole. It's like balance. Oh, it's just there's too much to unpackage there to try and make any sense of it because it's just genuinely baffling.
Yeah, FYI, also hard. Oh my god, incredible stuff. Yeah, I've got to say that is a really solid shout. What an addition that is to the corpus of erotic poetry. It's like Sappho, Catullus, Ryan Giggs
in his totem pole.
Oh god. Oh, I really don't want to think about his little Welsh totem pole. Okay, right, let's move on. Last award. And this is the cash out award. So I think in every season there are some players who become overrated, which is not to say they're not good, but they become overrated and suddenly they start getting linked to big teams, you know. And you always hear the same noises coming out of clubs, which is, nah, we're going to be ambitious. We want to keep hold of all our stars this summer. Interesting, you don't hear this from Brighton, who actually do get better every year.
Yeah.
So this is for a team with a player that they should sell now while that player's reputation is really high because they can get more than they're worth. And my shout here is João Palhinha. I think João Palhinha has had a good season. He has had a good season. He's linked with Liverpool and Bayern Munich for £50 million. If you could get £50 million for him, you should sell him instantly. Like, seriously. Like, there's this feeling that, like, a good Premier League player is, like, impossible to come by. And that's actually not true. Like, players who do specific things, particularly who put up defensive actions, are really easy to find. Those players, when they do it in one league, tend to be able to do it in other leagues. And Palhinha is, that's kind of all he is. He turns 28 in July. He's missed one game in 35. So you'd expect him to be kind of at the peak of his powers, to be operating really well in the team. And he does have huge defensive output. He's in the top 1% for tackles. Overall, he's top in the Prem for winning possession, 5.6 times a game. Which, by the way, is like, it's very good, but it's not like Ndidi at his best and N'Golo Kanté at his best good. You know, like, we've seen people win the ball 7 to 9 times a game in the Premier League, which is bananas. So 5.6 times is good, but it's not like, oh, wow, here is one of the best ball winners you'll ever see in your life. But you look at Fulham in 10th and you think, okay, this must be one of the reasons. And like I say, I do think he's been arguably their best player, apart from Leno maybe. But they've conceded 51. That's 11th in the league. But they've actually allowed 61 XG against, which is 15th in the league, and like 4 XG away from being bottom, like very close to the bottom. The defence has been absolutely horrible, and the only reason they've conceded a few goals is, one, because the shooting against them has been bad. You know, like, sometimes the opposition get chances and just shoot badly. Like, so the post-shot expected goals are lower than the expected goals, kind of the raw numbers. And Leno has saved 7 goals above expectation. That's what's kept them respectable. And that's why they're in mid-table instead of in the relegation fight. Because otherwise, that is what their underlying numbers suggest. And particularly since January, the underlying numbers say that Fulham have been the worst side in the league. Now, obviously, that's not all on him. But to say he deserves, you know, a move to a bigger side, is to say that he has made the team significantly better. And I don't know how bad this defense would be without him, if that's your kind of supposition. Like, what are you saying? That he's turning like an 80 XG against side into a 60 XG against side? That's the best case scenario, and it's just not plausible to me. And coupled with that, there are serious deficiencies in his game. He's in the bottom 18% for pass volume. Okay, Fulham aren't a possession side, you know, in the Prem, that's fine. But he's bang average for pass completion, despite also being in the bottom 8% for progressive passes. So this is a guy who doesn't pass much, who doesn't pass forward much, but who still completes passes at like an unimpressive rate. And he's in the bottom 2% for progressive carries, so he doesn't run forward either. So I just look at him and I think, this is a Fulham level defensive midfielder. Like, and you don't have to sell him. If nobody offers big money, then keep him by all means. You know, you might think, yeah, we would rather keep him and not have to go and replace him than, you know, get like 15 million. Like, if someone offers 35 or 40, that's not that much more than we spent. Like, we're just going to keep the player. I can get that. But if somebody's offering 50 mil, you should 100% take him. It shouldn't even be a question. It should be like, what are we going to do with that money? Because there are going to be a bunch of interesting players going down from the Premier League who actually could definitely do a job for Fulham. And I think that getting keyed into the players you have is just a really bad idea. I think you should always be philosophical about the players you have. Unless you've got a genuine, like, unicorn talent, like an incredible goal-scoring winger or something. By and large, especially with fullbacks and midfielders, where actually stats do a really good job of capturing their quality more than they do with, say, centre-backs, I would just say, right, we're going to sell this guy and move on. That's my take on Polina. And I think this is always, whenever I say anything like this to people, I think it's always painted as an anti-Polina view. I think of myself as very pro-Polina. I just think we don't have to pretend a player has been like one of the standout performers in the Premier League to acknowledge that, like, he's been good, but Fulham are worse than you think they are. Yeah.
But also, I think a lot of times when you say somebody's not worth what they're being linked to, doesn't necessarily mean that that player's bad.
No,
it just literally just means they can still be a good player. They're just not worth what the reports are saying that they might be transferred for.
Yes.
Those are two entirely different things,
isn't it? Yeah. It's the overrated thing. It's like, if somebody says that, like, Jack Grealish is one of the best, like, wingers of all time, he's obviously overrated. That is overrating him. That is not to say he's a bad player. Like, it's fucking stupid.
But in the same way, saying that he's not is not, is it's negative, but it's not saying that he's bad. He's still a very good player. And I think a lot of football fans struggle to understand that there's a middle ground in between the extremities.
Yeah.
But yeah. Right.
Well, on this topic, I feel like your shout fits into this perfectly, does it not?
Well, my shout for the cashed out award is Harry Kane. Because
woof.
The reports are saying that United want them, or United are linked heavily to him, short odds. And reportedly it will take £100 million in an upfront lump sum for him to swap Tottenham for United. Personally, I hate everything about this, because
is there no part of you that wants to see him play in a Man United shirt?
Maybe 4 years ago with a better manager and better players around him.
Wow, better manager.
Well, 4 years ago was what? Louis van Gaal or Mourinho?
Mourinho, I think, maybe.
Yeah. But regardless, at this stage, he's turning 30 this summer. So the next time he kicks a ball in the Premier League after the final two games of the season, he will be 30. So I'm considering him to be a 30-year-old if this transfer happens.
I think that's fair.
At £100 million, that would make him the second most expensive 30-year-old or older in history. First being Cristiano Ronaldo.
Jeez.
£105 million. So when you look at it like that, that is a huge amount of money to spend for somebody who maybe has two more peak years at best. It is a big, big investment. The next 30-year-old or over below that of all time was Casemiro to United, £70 million.
Whoa.
At 30. So I know I've just regaled that as a very, very good transfer. And I still stand by that, but the circumstances were different in that. So United wanted other players, didn't come. So they kind of used him as a stopgap with Eriksen. Very expensive stopgap, but it was more out of necessity. This Kane transfer reeks of desperation and short-sightedness because other options are available. Now, I don't want to go too much into that because that's not really the topic, but like Osimhen is available. Vlahovic, who I would be less optimistic about, but also available and have much, much longer shelf lives for very similar prices.
Yeah.
Like I said just there, Kane probably has two peak years left. So after that, you're already needing a succession plan. So the prospect of spending £100 million on a player that you have to consider an exit strategy for after two seasons doesn't really sit that well. And for the last, I think we've said before on other episodes that it feels like Spurs kind of shat the bed with their top-tier talent because they didn't sell them at their peak value.
Yeah.
And instead decided to keep them and tried to win something,
mm-hmm.
which they failed at. So naturally, now that we've reached this point, you would start to think that their prized assets are no longer worth what they want or what they... He's not worth what he once was, but he not worth anything enough to merit selling them.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you could argue that Spurs should have sold Harry Kane for like 100 to 150 when he was 27.
Or but even like... Yeah, I think they could have done it 2 years ago, right? So he'd have been just 20, about to turn 28. Yeah. So yeah, like that would have been that's literally an ideal time to sell.
And they probably would have got somewhere between 130 and 150, I would say, for
him.
Jesus,
yeah.
But they decided not to. And usually when that happens, that means you have foregone a big payout for that player and it better work out because if you don't win anything, you've kind of shafted yourself in terms of the regeneration of your squad because you missed out on a big payday. But no, he's turning 30 and yet he's still being linked with like $100 million plus move to a team like United. And for me, this feels like a bit of a get out of jail free card for Spurs because they took the gamble. They kept their good players. They kept their biggest players, their most expensive, valuable players, tried to win something and they got pretty close. They got the Champions League final, sure. But they didn't win anything. So now it's got to the stage where if you can get £100 million for a 30-year-old Harry Kane, fucking take it. Because Spurs are nowhere near winning the Premier League. They're nowhere near winning the Champions League. At best, they will nick a domestic cup in the next two or three seasons.
Which, or like the Conference League next season. Like,
but again, who cares?
They can't even go for the Europa League.
Yeah. So at best, still they can make a tournament that nobody cares about, really. And they will then have pumped they'll have squeezed the last of Harry Kane's juices out into his mid-30s. United will pay probably the biggest fee. Anybody who's linked with him, United will by far pay the biggest fee. You know, rival tax, British tax, all of that stuff. And to be honest, I think United are rich enough and stupid enough to potentially do it. If you can get $100 million for a 30-year-old Harry Kane, that realistically you should just sell now, reinvest that into the squad, because Son's not getting any younger. I think he's older. Son's 30, turning 31.
Son's older.
You know, Hugo Lloris has probably played his last game for Spurs. Like this, the Spurs of 2 years
ago. Which I feel like we've said like two seasons running.
Yeah. But it feels like it's true now.
Yeah.
This Spurs generation, this Spurs class of whatever, is coming to an end, or has pretty much come to an end. If you can get $100 million for one of your players, take it and reinvest that into your new cycle. Because I do not think he is worth $100 million. Okay, fair enough. He scored, 28 goals this season in the league, 23 non-penalty goals. Great. That's fine. That's a really good return. But the longevity of his performance at that level is the concern. And when you're spending that much money, 100 million pounds. I don't see many clubs out there that are dumb enough to take that on, just because of how short-sighted it is. But if Spurs can get 100 million pounds up front as well, lump sum, which is what has been reported, if they can get that, fucking bite United's hand off it. Hand off for him.
And it's not even like, you know, people always say, oh, it's hard to replace players at the top level. But like, look, I don't think Aston Villa are as good as they look this season. But Aston Villa sold Grealish for 100 mil and are now in a much better position than they ever were with Grealish. Like, they're challenging for Europa League football.
Even in the current market, 100 mil goes a long way.
It goes so far. Like, there's this idea of like, oh, well, we drop it all on a striker and then it would all be gone. It's like, well, you could just play Richarlison and you could buy, like, add it to your transfer funds and you could potentially buy like four 40 million pound players, which is like the majority of a new side. Plus, you've already got like Romero, you've already got Richarlison, you've already got Kulusevski, you've got Pape Matar-Sarr coming in. Like, you've got so many, you've got Spence, you've got so many interesting players who are either there or coming back. Destiny Udoji, who's coming in this summer. Like, there's loads of talent in that team. If you could add four starting quality players, and a £40 million player should be starting quality, Spurs are immediately in a miles better position. And it doesn't matter, really, if their striker's getting like 30 goals a season, if nobody else in the squad is doing anything. I mean, I know Son's got 10 goals this season, but like, Arsenal are showing you can maintain a title challenge without an out-and-out, you know, superstar scorer. City won the league last year without an out-and-out superstar scorer. Even Bayern Munich, you know, Thomas Tuchel has been saying recently, I actually want my Bayern side to function like Arsenal have this season, where we're not reliant on one guy, because that one guy who scores all your goals is almost impossible to find. It makes you fragile.
Yeah.
And the market just like, it doesn't kind of like lend itself to that at the moment. So we're going to do it another way. That's perfectly sensible. Spurs have got so scared of losing what they have that they've ignored the fact that they actually don't have very much at all. Like, I know the prospect of dropping from like, I guess they've been Champions League side, but the prospect of dropping from like fourth, fifth to like eighth, ninth seems awful.
Mm.
But it's worth doing that for a season or two if then you're like a first, second, third side, as opposed to like a team that's just like on the downslope.
It's happened to them already by them trying to avoid it happening.
Yeah.
Like keeping all the players, like they're already there.
But they always talk themselves back into it, right? So they're like, oh, well, you know, now we've slipped down. Now we definitely can't lose Kane. And you're like, oh, you're not losing him if you sell him for 100 mil.
100 mil at 30 years old.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I agree. I definitely would sell him. And like,
for that fee, yeah.
Like, I that's really a if Spurs, honestly, as a rival fan of Spurs, there is nothing I would love more for them to keep Kane.
Because they'll run him into the ground.
And then it would just be like, oh fuck, like, when are we ever gonna get like a proper forward in? Like, I really don't know how they'll do it. Like that, I look at Spurs right now and I'm like, Spurs being crap for the next 5 years looks like they decide to keep Kane and Kane steadily gets worse or he gets injured. Because obviously that will happen. Even if he had another two seasons like this, as you say, Spurs aren't gonna win the league. Spurs are not gonna win the Champions League. So, and what's the end game after that? Like, you also have to be in Europe in order to have minutes for new signings to embed themselves in the side. If Spurs end up not having Conference League football next season, then they are going to have a massive squad that's built to compete on multiple fronts, and they're going to have basically one competition to do it in, plus the FA Cup and the League Cup, which don't really count. So at that stage, it starts to get really, really hard to give enough minutes to new players to build the next generation of Tottenham. So, man, I'm concerned about that situation.
You've got like 45 games instead of 60 in a season.
Yeah. And they just need somebody who comes in and says like, you know what, I'm fine with you selling Kane. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, I want to win something in 5 years. I'm not here to like protect Enoch from like the fans who think Harry Kane is like a sacred cow.
They should have done it 3 years ago. If they can do it now for 100 mil, they've absolutely gotten out of jail from a bad decision.
Alright, should we move on to the burn book? Okay, burn book time, and this week in the burn book, I'm going to kick it off.
Cool.
With what I'm taking out of the burn book.
Right, okay.
Do you know Ruby Tando, who was on the Great British Bake Off?
I might know them to see. Let me Google. Is it the most recent Great British Bake Off?
No. It's like years ago. Anyway, she ended up like having a kind of like beef with Paul Hollywood. Like they really hate each other on Twitter, which is great. But she has this recipe for gnocchi,
okay,
with parmesan, capers, and chili crisp. So you know, like Lao Gan Ma chili crisp, that you get in like a Chinese specialty supermarket, plus like capers cooked in butter, and then you add parmesan on top, and it feels like it shouldn't work, and it is incredible. It is a supper you can pull together in minutes. It is salty and really spicy, because obviously you can make it as spicy as you want. It's really sour and sharp because it's got capers in it. It's just fucking great, and I think a midweek meal, which is done quickly and is genuinely legit delicious, is like honestly something to be treasured forever. Yeah. So I advise people to look up Ruby Tando chili crisp gnocchi, and you'll have a great time. It's really easy.
Do you pre-buy your gnocchi, or are you making that fresh?
No, I'm not making fucking gnocchi.
I mean...
I'm not an Italian peasant woman. Like, it's just like, I don't have like 6 hours a day to like make gnocchi and like milk a goat or whatever. Like, I'm a normal man.
Yeah, but you know, who knows what your hobbies are? You could be a keen gnocchi
trad
maker.
Wife. I can't be trad wifing out here. I would like to do that, but just buy good quality gnocchi or buy crap gnocchi. It literally doesn't matter. It's incredible. I heartily recommend it. That's what I'm taking out of the burn book. How about you?
I will definitely try that. Okay, so you've forced my hand here to start positive.
Yeah, start positive.
Which I'm very uncomfortable with, but we'll push through it. So I've, for various reasons, had to do a reasonable amount of traveling in the past 2 to 3 weeks. So both of mine are very travel-related. So what I'm taking out of the burn book is the fine British tradition of airport pints.
Oh, my God.
Now, I know you're not a fan of pints, really.
No.
But, honestly...
Too much liquid. Too much of one liquid.
This sacred event is one of the very, very few British traditions that I would like to attach myself to. Because it's just different. You go through security. And as soon as you get through security, you're straight to the pub. Doesn't matter what time it is. Could be 5 a.m. in the morning. That pub will be full of people having beers. Or at least drinking alcohol. And I'm not going to lie. When I walk past all the people sitting in the kind of general foyer, the general seating area, I genuinely look at them and think, what are you even doing with your life? Like, you need to have a long, hard look and assess your life decisions, because of the pub over there that serves beer and you're in an airport. And it is your service, it is your obligation to go and get a pint. Now, perhaps there's more leeway if it's before 10 a.m. But really, if it's after 10 a.m., sort your life out. Get to the pub. Even if you're not going on holiday, it still feels like a more special pint than
I guess you could have. You can always have like a screwdriver or something, you know, or like a cranberry juice and vodka, like something, you know, breakfasty.
Yeah. A Bloody Mary, you know, an alcoholic drink.
A Guinness.
Sure. But I mean, that comes in pint form.
Yeah, kick the day off with some iron.
I don't feel overly tied to Britain as a whole, as like a community, that much. But when you're sitting in a airport pub at like 6 a.m. in the morning, and you're just surrounded by other, like, it's full, and people are just drinking pints, there is an odd sense of just of pride, I suppose.
I wish people could see how seriously you are giving this speech, by the way.
An odd sense of nationalism that I have, that I don't really have with anything else. So yeah, it's a really special and sacred moment, the airport pint, and one that I almost never miss. And I miss it so infrequently that I remember the times I miss it. Like, I remember the times that I've not been able to have an AirPort pint. One was sad. Because I was deathly hungover and was being quite sick every 10 minutes. Another ones are just because I'm so late. At which point you then get an airplane pint, which is fine.
Do they serve pints on planes? Yeah.
Cans. Mm. Again, still, it's an alcoholic beverage in transit via air.
Okay. There is definitely something about the airport which is like, it's like international waters.
Yeah, you all know, better off.
Yeah, none of the rules count. It's not really a specific time. Like, it's not like 5 p.m.
It's like a casino
when
you can't see outside. Yeah.
Exactly. You're just like, I feel like the sun like operates at a different speed, like when you've gone through like check-in. So calories don't count when you're waiting. And the air doesn't feel real. So I feel like you're allowed to have like many airport pints. Yeah. I've got to say, the idea of having multiple drinks before going on a plane does not fill me with pleasure.
Depends on how long the plane is. Because also, you've got to factor in if it's a long plane, like a really long plane, generally the refreshments are complimentary.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it's free pints.
Yeah.
Or you've paid for your pints in your ticket. So maximizing that would be a priority. So you would tee yourself up nicely. Then when you get on the plane, you're like, I can get a lot of free pints and watch a lot of movies over the next 7 hours.
If it would put me to sleep, I'd do it.
That's what I love about long haul flights, is that I can put my earphones on, noise cancelling earphones, watch like 4 movies in a row and just kind of just have like 5 or 6 pints and nobody try and speak to me. Like, I don't even have to move. I just get up, go to the toilet, come back. Nobody
that does actually
to
kind of sound great. I would love to just sit and watch 4 films with everyone fucking shutting up and leaving me alone.
I have an immense amount of inner peace on long haul flights.
I feel like I'll never do one again where I'm not like wrangling a child.
Not for probably 17 more years.
Emma went to New York recently for work, like at the last minute, and you know, normally like the flight I think would be horrendous, but she like had a whale of a time because she was like, nobody asked anything of me for like 8 hours. I watched a bunch of shit films and ate like, you know, peanuts, salt peanuts, had a few pints,
some naps. Honestly, phenomenal.
I approve of the spirit of this, even if like the reality of it is not something that is necessarily for me. One day we'll probably be on a flight together and then I'll do an airport pint with you. I'm not an animal.
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's move on then. Should we get on to something we're happier with, which is like, what are we putting in the burn book this week?
What are you putting in? Because you started, so it's...
We could have snaked it, but yeah, sure. Okay, mine is really simple. There is a... Over the last half century...
Okay.
I didn't even do that on purpose, but mine's really simple. But over the last half century, there has been a steady growing influence in British English of American English. And some of this I'm fine with, you know? And a lot of it I use, some of it I don't use, but it doesn't bother me. Some of it I find strange. But when people say y'all, you know, Y apostrophe A-L-L, get in the fucking bin. Fuck off. Like, I see so... Every tweet I see now just starts with y'all, like, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, guys, like, stop this immediately. I don't understand it. I mean, it's annoying when people say A to Z when they can just say A to Z. It's annoying when people say, you know, Anthony when it's Anthony. Like, those things are irritating, but they're fine. Like, they really don't bother me. A to Z is objectively easier to say. Anthony looks like that. That looks like what it should be. These are completely acceptable things in my mind. But English people saying y'all, like, I'm okay with people saying ass to some degree, like ass. I do think it kind of makes more sense. I think arse written down looks fucking arse, stupid. And I think, you know, there are certain contexts where people say, like, you know, this is like a fucking silly ass, like, whatever thing. It sounds better if it's ass, but it still sounds stupid when you say it with an English accent, so maybe you just can't do it. But when people say y'all, even when Americans do it, it gets on my tits. When English people do it, I think, this is so cutesy. It's the same way that I don't use the word awesome. I don't say dude. Whenever people say dude, it fucking so gets my back up. Yeah. It really gets my back up. Like, you know what it is? It's a fucking Christian thing to do. Christians do it. When I was growing up, there were so many Christians who'd be like, hey, dude, you know, I just want to talk to you about God. And you know what? God's awesome. And I was just like...
let's have a little powwow about God.
If God was real, he'd hate you. Like, yeah. I hate you. Shut up.
I get the same guy would pull up a chair and sit on it backwards.
Oh, I'd almost appreciate that. Like, if I'd met more, like, Poochie-style Christians. Like, the Poochie Christian is a real genre. But, yeah, I don't know. There's, like, this fake... There's almost this fake, like... They all think they're Patrick Swayze in Point Break. But they don't seem to realise that's Buddhists. So, yeah, this just... There's this particular kind of, like, fake... sort of valley speak. I know I say things like and it annoys people. I know that there are things like goddamn or whatever, which I guess are Americanisms, and motherfucker, which is an Americanism. But like, dude, you're awesome. Get the fuck out of here. I hate all of them. As soon as I hear them, I think you might not be a person I can seriously relate to.
There's an immense level of ick that comes with a lot of those terms.
Yes,
like,
there is.
Instant ick. It oozes ick. Awesome oozes ick. Dude
awesome.
Oozes
oh,
ick.
Awesome. Shut the fuck up. Shut up. If it has a use, I'm fine with it. But when it's just, it's the tweeness of it. I cannot cope. So,
There are so many better alternatives. There's so many better alternatives that you could have used, but you've chosen to use ones that are just horrific.
Yeah. It's like cuck English. I hate it. Let's not get into that. Okay. What are you putting in the burn book? Rescue me.
So what I'm putting in the burn book this week is the other side of traveling. So I don't understand how there are idiots who still do not know how to travel on planes properly. And yes. I've never understood this.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't understand why this always happens every time you're at an airport, that there are people who just do not know what's going on, or just do not know how to navigate the travel from one airport to another. Commercial aviation has existed for nearly 100 years. And for the last like 15 years, it's been like exactly the same in its current format.
Yeah.
How are you not prepared? Right. Going through security. How about you don't take 45 minutes to get prepared? How about you put your liquids in a bag before you get to the airport when
that
you're packing crazy. Your bag? How about you don't ask airport security to make an exception for your liquids that are too big or that you didn't check the size of, because they're not going to make an exception for you? How about you actually take out everything you need to take out, like laptops and iPads, because, you know, there's an airport security person who's telling you every 20 seconds, please remove all laptops and iPads and put them in their own container. How has your bag made it through the entire X-ray machine with your laptop still in it? Explain to me what you didn't understand about the man standing in front of you telling you to take your laptop out of your bag every 30 seconds that you then were like, actually, you know what? That doesn't apply to me. I'm just going to stick my laptops in there, but it's fine. Sure, cool. I'll just slow everybody down.
Mm.
How is it difficult? And that's only just getting through security. Getting on the plane. What is it with the idiots who stand in a queue for 20 minutes before the plane starts boarding? They're standing at the boarding desk, but it's not even boarding yet. They're just forming a queue.
But they love it. They love to queue.
No, but we all have a seat. We're all getting on the same plane. The likelihood of you getting kicked off the plane as well is super small, because generally, if they've oversold the flight, they'll ask for somebody to sacrifice their seat before they start actually kicking somebody off.
Yeah.
The chance of you actually not getting on that plane is so small. You don't need to stand up for 40 minutes in a queue before the boarding starts. Sit down like a normal person.
Yeah.
Same goes for when the plane lands. Why do you stand up the moment the wheels touch the ground. We're all getting off. You're actually making it more difficult for people to get off because you're standing in the middle of the plane and forming a immovable queue. You can just sit down until they open the doors. Then everybody can one by one go and get their bags and walk off in an orderly fashion, as opposed to this weird like perching that everybody does, half on their seat, half off it, desperate to get off a plane so we can all stand beside each other at the luggage belt and get our luggage at the same time.
But at least with that, I think you can imagine, like, it is possible that you do get off faster. What annoys me more is the selfishness. Well, you know when you're getting on and you're just standing?
Oh, and someone's standing in front of you. Just
someone's just in the aisle, like, fucking adjusting their bag. And I'm like, why don't you just get out of the aisle? Let us all get on. When a natural break occurs, just nip out and put your bag up. In the same way, don't bring a fucking bag on a plane that you're incapable of lifting into the overhead locker. The number of times that someone's like, oh, can you just help me put it up there? And I'm kind of like, I will help you, but honestly, you should carry a bag that you can carry.
This, like, is your responsibility.
I don't carry around, I don't carry around like 150 kilos worth of weight because I know I'm not capable of managing it. Like, that is irresponsible.
There are so many infuriating things that people do. Like, in the when you get on the plane, if somebody holds up the entire row because they're like fishing through their bag to get their glasses out or their iPod out.
God.
Something that they knew they would need or want on the flight that they could have previously got out of their bag before they got on the plane so that they could have just put their bag in the overhead locker and not hold everybody up. Idiot. And then on the flight I was on last night, actually there was a new one. There were two people behind me, unrelated, two different people, but somehow, I don't know how idiots got paired together, but the in-flight refreshment trolley arrived. And then these two people started like questioning the flight attendants as to what was available. What could they have? One man requested tuna and rice as if they have a fucking restaurant in the cockpit. There's literally a menu in the seat pocket in front of you. Open it. That tells you everything you will ever need to know about the refreshments available.
And also it tells you what's on the plane. As in, it's not like, it's not like a thing where they're like, oh, we'll just send somebody out for that. No. Even if you had the money, they'd be like, we're on a plane.
Yeah.
This is what we have.
So this guy was like, what sandwiches do you have? They're literally all documented in a nice little laminated sheet in front of you. You could have looked at that before. And he's like, okay, do you have any like rice, tuna and rice? And they were like, no, obviously we do not. This is a plane.
And tuna and rice? Why would anyone want that anyway? It's like, are you on hunger strike? Are you fucking like just Christian Bale preparing for The Machinist? Like, what are you doing?
But honestly, it was just baffling. Like, I don't know. I just don't understand that because I don't know how you do it. But I will know exactly what I want before they arrive.
Yes.
I will have my payment method ready and I will practice my order in my head at least three times so I know exactly what I'm going to say to ensure like peak efficiency in ordering.
Wow. So I'd say that's excessive, but like, yeah, sure. I mean, like, well, look, I was going to say we've been to a restaurant before, but like, That was like a set menu. But if you're going to a restaurant, you look at the menu in advance and you pretty much know what you're going to have, barring the addition of some incredible special, I think. On a plane, there's so much more of an incentive to be quick. And let's be honest as well, if you get a drink or a sandwich, which is not like your favorite in the world, the stakes are pretty low. It's not like a restaurant where you're like, I'll never get a chance to come to Noma again. It's a fucking plane. Like, if you end up with a chicken salad sandwich instead of a cheese sandwich, you're not going to spend the rest of your life thinking about what might have been. You're just going to eat the fucking sandwich and shut up. And everybody else wants you to do that.
And also, everything comes pre-prepared. They are not capable of, like, substitutions are not a thing. Like, they are not making the sandwiches. They are taking them out of a packet, sticking them in some heating device, and then giving them to you.
Yeah.
That is it. Everything you need to know is on the page in front of you. Look at it. Ask them for it. Pay them for it. Shut up.
Agreed. I think that's the broader lesson of the burn book, isn't it? That everyone who's not us but annoys us should always shut up. But no, I think you're absolutely right. I think air travel is unpleasant enough without other people making it more unpleasant by being stupid, slow, and selfish. Bin everyone. That brings us to the close of our public episode, and I'm glad, you know, like what a payback for having to wait an extra week, I think. We will see those of you on the subscription side who do subscribe. If you would like to get access to an extra 2 episodes a month, then please do join us. It's $6 a month in order to get access to those extra episodes, which means that you then get an episode each week, basically, if you want to kind of ration it out like that, I guess. And of course, you can submit your questions to us if you are a subscriber. We'll see you over there, and the rest of you will see next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.